I warn you, I'm on first cup of coffee yet, so I'm not quite here, but I'm close. This is February 17th already, and this is the Subcommittee on Human Resources, and we're going to hear from the DD community today. Would you like to lead us through this, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, so today there's actually a couple things in the agenda. One is an overview from the Department of Human Services on the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program. You started to hear a little about that program yesterday. And then there's also on the agenda is to take action on a grant federal grant application request from the Oregon Health Authority, and the plan is to do that towards the end of the meeting.
Thank you. And so at the end of the meeting, we'll stop at 10 minutes to the end of the meeting and take the grant up, and then we're kind of where we're at. And I'll apologize for those of you who were here yesterday. I didn't make it yesterday. We had a problem with our family we had to take care of, and it's been taken care of. So away we go here. So without any questions, seeing none, introduce yourselves to us, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the Director of the Office of Developmental Disability Services.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. I'm Erin Kelly Seal, Director of the Department of Human Services.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. Eric Moore, CFO for the DHS.
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. For the record, Tamara Brickman with the Department of Administrative Services, CFO Office.
All right, good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to be here today to provide a program overview of the programs that Oregon has for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Over the past biennium, these programs have undergone a significant amount of growth and change. They've improved for many people that we serve, and we've also had a number of challenges that we have faced and that have led to many opportunities that we continue to address. And we're looking forward to talking about the overall program today and addressing any questions or issues that may come up as we go through it. Today's outline of our program, we're just going to do a general program overview, accomplishments, go through the basics of who we serve, challenges and opportunities. Eric will provide an overview of the budget. Then we're going to talk about our future investments, and then we'll have a special discussion around employment for our Employment First initiative. Over the past biennium, we did move forward as directed with the Community First Choice Option, or K-Plan, which you've already heard a great deal about from APD and in the discussions yesterday. As a result of that, we really, as the DD system, got to a point where we needed to come together and really affirm our vision for the system of supports for the people that we're serving. And so we did that in a stakeholder meeting in November of 2014. And this is the vision that we came up with, which really speaks to the fact that our system of supports needs to be simple to use and responsive to the strengths, needs, and direction of the people and families who live as valued members of their community. Since we came to agreement on this vision statement, it's really been what we've been using to guide what we do and how we think about our system and our services. And we're very pleased at the stakeholder engagement and involvement in development of this statement. It's also consistent with the core values that were set forth in Senate Bill 22 around choice and self-determination, integration and community services, developing services that are consistent with choice, ensuring that individuals and families and advocates play a major role, a significant role in the services they have to support them, and really talking about integration and independence of the those we serve in the community. So these right now are vision and our core values as we go forward with all of the program changes and issues that we deal with on a daily basis. It's important to note, and we did hit on this a little bit yesterday, that Oregon is and continues to be a national leader in the realm of serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We are one of only three states with no large public or even private institutional settings for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That means that ultimately every person that we serve is served in a community setting, whether they have very low level of need or whether they have the highest, most extensive level of need. We also engaged in the Community First Choice Plan, or K-Plan, at the direction of the legislature. This really was an initiative that had just come out as a result of the Affordable Care Act at the federal level. Oregon jumped right on it and did so in a way that grouped a number of different services under this particular option, which is part of the work of the DD system over the last 2 years, is really figuring out with CMS how this works and how we can effectively implement this sweeping initiative. It did expand services for a number of people that we serve, especially for children. And I've got, in the context of that, we know that we're now serving, as you'll see later in the presentation, we're serving more children now than we have ever before, and we expect that trend to continue in 15-17. We know, we've heard from mothers. I've got Gloria, who's a mother of two sons with autism, who had quit her job to care for her sons. She's now able to get the support she needs for her sons, and it really has stabilized the family and prevented what could have been a very significant challenge or crisis situation. And so that's an example that you'll hear a few more of as we go about how these services now are really proactive and heading off what would have otherwise been crisis situations. In the context of who we serve, as I mentioned earlier, we serve people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, from individuals with a low-level need to the most significant level of need. Those individuals that we serve with the highest level of need are often supported in our stabilization and crisis unit. That unit really represents for adults and children, ultimately, with intellectual and developmental disabilities and possibly co-occurring mental health issues, kind of the option of last resort in terms of where they can be served and supported. And we're working very hard to ensure the safety of the people that live there, but also especially of the staff that work there. And that's something we continue to be engaged on as we go forward in our efforts to improve services for everyone. In total, at this point, we serve about 22,000 people who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities. This includes, you know, the Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, autism spectrum disorders, acquired brain injury, and then also children who have been affected by fetal alcohol or other drug-affected children. Ultimately, what this means in terms of diagnosis is that a developmental disability is diagnosed before the age of 22, and an intellectual disability needs to be diagnosed before the age of 18. It has to be something that's going to continue indefinitely throughout the person's lifetime. So if you think about it in the context of a lifespan of support, that is really what the DD system is creating and supporting, is a lifetime of services. Medicaid financial eligibility is also required for these programs. Over the next few slides, I'm going to show what we're seeing in terms of trends and what we have seen over the last couple of years with implementation of the Community First Choice option. This slide shows us children who are accessing services, and the number of children accessing services in residential settings is pretty consistent. We expect it to be pretty consistent with a slight bump in 15-17. Obviously, where you see the significant increase in these programs is in children who are receiving in-home supports. From the point of implementing the K, we've increased to about 898 children that we're serving in 2014. With what we know is coming through the pipeline in terms of eligibility processes and planning processes and who we expect we're going to see in 15-17, we expect that to jump significantly up to about 2,500 children in the 15-17 biennium. We also expect with that, though, that the majority of these children are going to be served in-home, in their homes with their families, which is clearly the most cost-effective and most appropriate way to serve children with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Can I stop you there for a minute, just
sure.
A second? Any questions at this point? I have a question. This might be for Eric, actually. The slide's a little hard to read because you're doing 2 years instead of 1 year, but do you expect this to stabilize as far as the number of children being served at some point? Because this is a trajectory that's going up in caseload pretty quickly. Not saying we shouldn't do it. It's part of the K waiver. Probably some other things driving it, too. I'm guessing autism, drug and alcohol abuse in pregnant women, all those things. But are we looking at something that's going to, you think it's going to peak out somewhere, or is it going to be continuing upward spiral? Eric, do you think you have any idea on that? maybe you do.
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, I think it's We would expect at some point for this to level off. As you mentioned yourself, with what the diagnoses you indicated, part of the challenges with this continue. Autism, if you look at our the diagnoses, our qualifying diagnoses for children that are coming into the system, autism is the prevalent diagnosis. So we expect the number of children we serve ultimately to kind of follow that trend. And if that trend levels off, then we would expect this to level off to some extent. One of the things that we have happening right now is even at this point, to us, it feels like we've been operating under the K plan for a long time. It's been about 2 years. For family members and people who are out in different parts of the community, they're still learning about this. They haven't heard. They may not know. And so I think we're going to continue to see an upward trajectory, regardless ultimately of what other diagnostic issues occur, because as people learn that supports are available, they will come out of ultimately what we call the woodwork, and they will come in and try to get supports for their children, as we would expect and ultimately want them to do as part of this process.
I was very involved in the ABA program for autism, as you are aware of, and the battles went on around that. Clearly, it's something that has to be covered now, which I support. Are these programs mean tested or not? I'd like to know what that level is. And what about our partners in K-12? One of the issues here is that a lot of the work you're going to be doing with children at home probably used to be done in the schools with independent education plans and function at the school. We want to integrate those in some way, not just relieve the schools of that and drop it all back on DHS. So those are really difficult questions, but they also really drive caseload, and they really drive cost to that caseload.
Co-Chair Bates,
any comments you might have on that, I'd appreciate.
I can give you a couple, Co-Chair Bates. Thank you. The first is in terms of means testing. For adults, they are required to meet regular Medicaid financial eligibility requirements. For children, we actually do a presumptive eligibility process, which means we don't look at the income of parents at this point. We only look at the income of children. So that is a part of the increase in the number of children we're seeing is children who, because we don't look at parental income, they have a disability, they have a qualifying disability, and then they come into the system through Medicaid.
Why don't we talk about that again later, okay? Continue your presentation.
All right.
I can see a situation where you might have a very wealthy family getting these services, and I don't want to be in a situation where we're dealing with that when others are being limited in what they're getting to. Okay?
And Co-Chair Bates, I will say in terms of we can definitely continue to have that discussion. I would also talk about in terms of you mentioned K through 12 or our partners in K through 12. Absolutely, Medicaid funding is intended to. It is not intended to supplant or take the place of what's happening in the school system. Oftentimes, we are hopeful that by providing supports in the home, outside of school, that helps with the school environment, and we definitely have examples. I've got a young man named Nathan whose support that he gets through the K plan in his home has helped him stabilize at home and has also helped him improve at school. We're not supporting what happens at school, we're supporting what happens at home, but as a result of the support at home, he's also improving at school, and his mother's very excited about the next year and optimistic for his outcome and his future.
Stop there. There's a question on the side.
Thank you, Chair Bates. So I want to just kind of clarify and follow up with what Senator Bates was saying on the spike of, you know, up to 2458 there. The K plan, because you mentioned some different diagnoses and, you know, the Asperger's autism spectrum and additional diagnosis that's there. But to my understanding, the K plan basically expanded eligibility and expanded services, so more people are qualifying for more services. And so wouldn't that account for the majority of that increase, in which case, once people realize they can access it and figure out how to access it, those numbers should stable out and have a smaller fluctuation? Is that accurate?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Stark, I think that's a very good point. I would say it didn't change how we identify DD eligibility or level of care. And so just as a I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but if somebody has Asperger's, they still have to meet some functional deficits in order to be eligible. So it didn't expand it that way. What it did do, though, you're absolutely correct, is open up eligibility to children in a way that we hadn't had before. Before, our children's services was capped under certain waivers, and now with K-Plan, it is basically an entitlement because it's on the state plan, and so anyone who meets the eligibility criteria, we can't tell them you have to wait for services. They can now come into services.
Okay, thank you.
And I want to make it clear, too, I'm not opposed to what you're doing. I'm really glad you're doing it. I think it's something that you've been doing for a long time, but I have to be a little pragmatic, too, so I want to make sure we do it the right way and that we're not talking to our friends at the at CMS about how we're implementing the K plan and what we're doing. So don't take it the wrong way. I got another set of responsibilities to make these budgets balance, okay?
Coach Bates, if I could just weigh in for briefly, I just want to play historian for a minute. The capped waiver kids programs that we had before had wait lists. We had families that were waiting for services, and this was an issue the legislature discussed for the last decade about can we not afford the caps. I do want to just emphasize that the reimbursement federally for this program, for this expansion, is greater than we would have had we moved forward with the expanded waivers, and so we're having more federal contribution. I think, though, just reflecting on your comments and discussion that Lily and I have had, is that as we've opened the door more broadly, as we're making sure that our partnerships around the kids' service system are strong, not just with education, but also child welfare, differential response, very consistent policy goals about keeping children at home with families, what we're recognizing is that it's a really great opportunity for Oregon on the go forward to talk about the DD kids' serving system more holistically than we've really had an opportunity to do in the past because of our very limited and waitlisted constrained programs. So this is an opportunity, I think, for all of us to talk about what makes sense as we go here and how we work to support families to be able to serve their children as best they can.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Chair Bates. We have been having a discussion in the Human Services Policy about tax credits, and I know the tax credits for children with disabilities, the number of children with disabilities has gone up a lot. Would this be related to that, too, the number that are classified as disabled has actually gone up over the last few years?
Co-Chair Bates and Representative Kinnegeyer, I'm not familiar with that particular program. I would think, kind of going back to what Aaron was talking about in terms of CAP, I don't think the change in the program hasn't changed the diagnostic criteria for who has a disability. So I'm not sure how, what had happened before is we had this many children out there just waiting for services, not getting anything. So I don't know how that ties, I can't speak to how that ties into the tax credit, and I don't know.
Although, Co-Chair Bates and Representative Kinnegeyer, I do think there are two dynamics going on here that we've talked about. One is that this program has changed. The other is that we are seeing an increase in the prevalence of autism as a diagnosis. And so I think that those two things coming together around this particular program are driving some of the growth in different ways. As you all know, when you look at our caseload forecasts, and they are online if you ever want to take a look and review more closely the assumptions they're making, it's hardest to make accurate assumptions when policy is so dramatically changed like the K-Plan has done with our kids' programs. And so right now what we're seeing is a lot of variability that we're still learning from. And I think over time, as we have a better sense of how those two drivers are impacting caseload, we'll get more accurate in our ability to talk with you about what we can expect in terms of caseload for kids.
Please continue.
All right, thank you. As we discussed, this just shows the average cost per case. Obviously, children's in-home service, although we're serving many more children, we're doing it in-home, which is the most cost-effective way to do it. And ultimately, in a lot of ways, by doing that, we are averting crisis situations for families, which is always a good thing and what we want to do in our system. In terms of adults who are accessing services, you'll note here in this chart, what we're showing is that adults, in terms of accessing residential in-home supports, the total numbers, you don't see that significant spike like you did with children. And the reason for that is because historically under the prior programs, when teens turned 18, they did have access to a support services waiver that was capped. And so while the supports they received were capped and not everyone There were some people maybe who needed more than that. Ultimately, everyone was receiving service. So we do have people coming in. We've heard from our county developmental disabilities programs. We do have adults who haven't heard about the program now coming into services. But the increase in terms of the number of people coming in once they're adults hasn't hit us as much as we've seen with children. In terms of the adult service system, we're looking at the average cost per case. What we see here is consistent with, I think, you know, what we would expect to some extent with this program, our adult residential programs. The cost is increasing on a fairly consistent basis, and that has a lot to do with the aging of the population and just the increasing need of the folks in those residential settings. For the adult in-home services, the increase here is tied to a great deal to what I just mentioned before, where prior to this, there was a capped amount of funding that people who are 18 and over could access until they reached a crisis point and needed to go into a residential setting. With the K plan and with the direction that we got in the budget note for 13-15, we have moved to a system where those caps no longer exist, and where we're providing support based on the assessment of a person's need. And so a person who may have been getting supports under that capped amount may now have an assessment that puts their support need at much higher than that, and they're getting that additional level of support. And that has been helpful to adults that have received that support. There's a gentleman named Tony whose family helped him move into an apartment independently and under the capped support service program, and he was living independently, but the family was still providing a lot of the in-home supports that he needed. His parents are aging, and that was becoming a challenge for them, and it was a near crisis situation because they couldn't continue to provide the supports he needed for him to be successful. With implementation of the K plan, he's now continues to live successfully in his apartment. Those supports are being provided through the K, and his family is greatly relieved because they're not creating a crisis situation for him.
Sure. Coach Bates, if I could just weigh in on this, I think what could have happened in that situation that Lilia just described previously is if the family, because of their age, was unable to continue supporting him, he would have ended up in the higher cost residential care as opposed to being able to continue to be supported in the community at home. We've had families at town hall meetings. I've had personally families approach me at town hall meetings thanking me that now they're children who are in their 30s are going to be able to remain as active members of their community because of these supports, as opposed to then moving into 24-hour care. The other thing I just want to mention around the cost per case, it's hard to believe but can be easy to forget that rates in this program have been changing quite a bit during the recession. Rates were reduced significantly in the developmental disabilities programs. They're not caught up to where they were previously, but there has been some catch-up for some services around rates through investments that you all made. But one of the cost drivers in terms of some of the variation in cost here is also that we had significant budget reduction and then the beginning of reinvestment as we came out of the recession in the 13-15 budget. So I just wanted to point that out as well.
Thank you. Senator Steiner-Haywood.
Just a quick clarification, if I could. Ms. Tennanty, you mentioned that people need to reach out for services before they turn 18. What happens when we have families with older children who move into the state who've been receiving services elsewhere? I'm just thinking about, because I happen to know a family where this is the case. They moved here because one of the parents got a job in Oregon. The child, not a child anymore, 22 or 23, had been receiving services in their previous state. How does that work under Oregon's system?
Coach Bates, Senator Steiner-Hayward, that is a good question. And ultimately, Medicaid, unlike Medicare, Medicaid is a very state-specific program. And so every state has a different Medicaid program under the same basic framework for CMS. And so for that family, if they moved here from another state, the Medicaid that the child or the adult child may have had in that state doesn't transfer with them, and so now they're a resident of Oregon and they become eligible for our services and for the K plan services. And so hopefully
they're all set. They've gotten great support. They're good. I think it's an important point because you did mention specifically that they had to apply before they were 18, and we do have situations where people are coming in from other places, families move here, and I want to make sure that people understand that other people are eligible.
And Let me clarify that. The whatever the condition is has to be diagnosed before 18 or 22. They don't have to apply before those points. They can be adults moving into the state, but if they have documentation of the diagnosis prior to that, then they, so thank you for the clarification.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Ms. Tennity.
All right.
Excuse me. Another question. Eric? Hi. I'm looking at these two slides and sort of putting them together in my head here. It looks like adult residential caseload is pretty static, which you'd hope it would be. And costs going up, pretty static. Costs may be going up because they need greater, they have greater needs. And it looks like cost for in-home care is cost is going up, but caseload's going up there too. Which, but the cost difference is huge. You know, it's 3 to 4 times more expensive to place somebody in a residential setting. So if you could, at a later time, show me where those things intersect, the total cost of the program, what's happening here. My guess is we're actually coming out even or saving a little bit of money from the number of people being served. But I'd like to see those numbers. We get a chance to kind of put that together. Sure. You understand what I'm saying?
Coach Bates, we can provide that information.
I can't quite put the slides together, and I can't do the math right now, but I hope you could do it for me, and we can take a look at what's going on. I think you're moving in the right direction. It's great. And to follow up on what Senator Steiner Hayward said, I commonly have people moving in from California to Southern Oregon. Mm-hmm. They start accessing services for their children, and they move back to California over those issues. That stopped about a year and a half ago. So something's changed in our system. I think it's the K waiver. But what they could get in California was far superior to what they could get here, and that's changed. And so I appreciate the work you're doing. Something's changed out there, and it's a good change. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nason.
Thank you. You've mentioned supports several times, many times. It's on the slides. Just to make this real for people who are listening who don't live in this world all the time, give us an example of 4 or 5 kinds of supports that allow someone like the example you just told us about to stay in their home.
Okay. Thank you. Co-chair Nathanson and Bates. The types of services we provide, and in this example of the supports that really allow a person to stay in their home, the primary program that we have or the primary service we offer is called in-home support. And it's basically provided either through a personal support worker or through a direct support professional hired through a community agency. And they come into the home and provide the supports for the individual in the home. We also have a supported living program that can do a similar thing where it provides supports to persons, to people who are living independently. From there, we have our 24-hour support systems, which are group home settings, adult foster care, children's foster care for children as well. And then, as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, for those with the most significant needs in our system, our state, stabilization and crisis unit. In addition, there are kind of daytime supports that people can access, and we'll be talking a little bit more about those as we go on, around employment services and employment supports and day activities for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
You want a little more specific answer?
The names of the programs, but for those people who are listening, what exactly are supports? Preparing meals, helping with bathing or dressing, helping with managing their personal finances or grocery shopping. Give us an example of what these supports are in this program area.
Thank you. I will go into more detail. So an individual who lives, an individual that we talked about who may live independently in an apartment and have in-home support, someone coming in. The person who's coming in may do any number of the things that you mentioned. They may help the person prepare a meal. They may help the person manage their money. They may help the person with activities of daily living, like we discussed a little bit yesterday, bathing, dressing, using the restroom, those kinds of things. We also would expect that person, the person who's being supported, has gone through the process of having an individual support plan developed where they identify the goals that they themselves want to achieve. And then our expectation is that the support that's provided by the in-home provider or the supported living provider, whoever the provider might be, they're helping that person work toward whatever goal it is they want to achieve. So if the goal is that I want to learn how to cook, that they're really supporting them in being able to do that. If the goal is, you know, I want to get a job, then our expectation is through our employment support systems that that's happening. So the services that are provided can be categorized as supporting someone with their activities of daily living, helping them integrate into their local community. But ultimately, all of those supports should be driven by the goals that each individual has for themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if someone has a chronic health condition and needs to take a certain pill or oral medication every day without fail? Or what if they have just a temporary situation? They, you know, got cut, you know, while like slicing an onion or something. And so it has a wound that you need to make sure it's not getting infected. Would someone coming in doing personal support care be able to check to see, are they taking their pill every day, or are they changing the Band-Aid? Do they need help understanding that, you know, it needs an antibiotic to keep from being infected? How much does that cross over into the health area?
Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson, in the example, I'll start with the example of the wound, because from my perspective, I think that's a little bit easier to answer. We would absolutely expect that whoever's coming in the home to provide support is making sure the person's, you know, that they've gotten the attention, the medical attention they might need, that the wound is cared for, and that the person is doing the follow-up that may have been required by whatever doctor system they went to. In terms of medication or medication management, really that is going to come down to, we would want them to check and make sure the person is taking their medication, but then of course we have delegation issues with under the Nurse Practice Act and those kinds of things. So it depends on the extent to which that's happening, and is the person responsible for their own medication? And then if they're responsible for their own medication, how is the support worker kind of helping to make sure that that's happening?
Okay, thanks.
Chair. Thank you, Chair Bates. And so Chair Nathanson, just to kind of help clarify or reiterate some of what they're saying, from personal experience, I worked in an adult IDD home for a season. And I think the reason it's difficult to really pinpoint what are all the supports is because it's so vast. And, you know, we had 6 residents in the adult foster care home I worked in. And quite frankly, with no disrespect to the adult IDD population, it's very similar to my life now with 5 children running a different age span. Okay, my 9-year-old needs a different amount of supports than my 3-year-olds. And so, and with the population there, some of them, it might be every little thing throughout the day. You are literally helping them put on their shirt, walk from their bedroom to their front room. And some, it might be you make breakfast and help them get on the bus. And so it really does, it ranges so extreme, so it's hard to identify. But if you can imagine someone needing help with it, then these supports tend to encompass that in one way or another.
Well put, Representative Stark. I feel like I should be sitting down there answering the questions, because I deal with this population every day, and it's really one of the enjoyable parts of my life in seeing these patients. And they come in usually with their caretaker, comes with them quite often, and brings them to the office, and we go through what's going on for that individual, either mom or dad or a caretaker. The other thing you haven't mentioned here is that for a lot of families, this is a form of respite care. Mm-hmm. The family can leave for an hour or two and go shopping, do what they need to do while the care workers there, so that's a part of it also. But I don't want to interrupt your presentation too much here, so please keep going.
Well, thank you. Co-Chair Bates and Representative Stark, I'm glad to hear that you have got some experience and understanding of these systems. We're going to talk a little bit now about the accomplishments, because in the midst of all of the changes that's occurred, we have achieved some accomplishments over the past biennium. As we've spent most of this our morning talking about so far, we have definitely implemented the Community First Choice or K-Plan option. Supports are not crisis-driven. They're better able to assist with sudden life changes, and I've given some examples of that. They also are able to come into a family who may need short-term respite or other types of support and really provide that for a family to prevent a longer-term crisis from occurring or an out-of-home placement from occurring. We've also implemented a number of employment services. We took what had been a bundled day service and broke it up into a number of different services, distinct services, individual support employment, discovery, job development. We also do small group support employment, and then also employment path services. And this was really at the direction of, not only at our direction and wanting to do the right thing and making sure that we were supporting people to gain integrated employment and have good, meaningful daytime activities, but also at the direction of CMS, who had looked at our bundled service where we just paid one amount for the entire day, and they had pretty clearly, they have given us guidance and direction that we needed to break those apart so that they could tell and we could tell exactly what was occurring in a person's life on a day-to-day basis. We also move forward again under guidance and direction from CMS, improving our quality assurance systems. As a result of an investment that was made in 13-15, we have a team now of quality assurance specialists who are going to go out, who are now going out actually into our community developmental disability programs and our brokerages. CDDPs and brokerages serve as our case management entities in the IDDD system. They've developed a tool to expedite reporting. And then we also have a small group of trainers who go out and follow up with them to kind of to provide support in terms of when the review finds something that needs to be addressed, they come out and find and help training around that. What the types of things the review is looking at is our health and safety needs of the individuals being addressed. Does the annual assessment appropriately reflect the individual support needs? Is there a current support plan demonstrating how the individual is receiving services and meeting their goals? And our providers that deliver the services have they met the provider requirements, and are they doing what they need to do? So really, this is a big initiative around quality assurance and compliance, ultimately, with federal regulations.
Lily, just for a second, could you step back and for me at least, remind me of the function and what CDDPs do? I've kind of forgotten. I know brokerages very well. Others may not know either one. Just take a second and tell us about those two programs real quickly so everybody's on the same
sure.
page.
Sure. Co-Chair Bates, I'd be happy to. County developmental disability programs are really for the IDD system, our point of entry. They are our system point of entry. So when we talk about children coming into the system and new adults coming into the system, they go through each of their county CDDPs, and the county determines eligibility, determines a level of care, and works with them to initiate the service process. And then they either stay and continue to be case managed by have a case manager or a service coordinator through the county, or if they're an adult, they also get the option to go to select a brokerage and go receive case management or personal agent services through a brokerage. So the county is kind of the point of entry, and then both systems provide the function of case management based on the choice of the individual and where they want to go.
Are those people direct DHS workers or are they county workers?
These individuals, the county CDDPs are county-based employees. They are not state employees. And then the brokerages are private, contracted, nonprofit entities.
What's the uniformity of the CDDPs? Do you feel like they're pretty uniform around the state, or does it vary quite a bit county to county? Is any county monies involved?
Co-Chair Bates. We are working to create more consistency from county to county. That is something that's been a big part of our efforts over the last couple of years. In terms of county monies, that's some information I can provide. I think we have some that have county monies coming into them, but I can't speak to exactly which ones. Ultimately, though, these programs are Medicaid funded, and so they're matched with state, the general fund, and then the Medicaid match.
Co-Chair Bates and members of the committee, I would mention that some counties have opted out of these services, and in recent time, as that has occurred, we have sought contracted services in place of the CCDP. A few years back, and I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly when, the one county for which that would be an exception is Umatilla County. The state did have employees running the county developmental disability program for Umatilla for some time. We're now transitioning that work back to Umatilla County. We're in the process of doing that. So once that occurs, there will not be any local county services that are directly provided by state employees, although there are some that are not provided by the county, but for which the state now has a contract. And we can give you a map and give you some detail, if you'd like, about where that's happened. Douglas County recently, for example, gave the state notice that they were no longer financially able to support the DD program, and so that we've now contracted out for services in that community. It is an issue, too, I just would point out, especially as the legislature is talking about the ongoing role of counties in the mental health system, many of our developmental disability directors at the county level work under their mental health director. And if you look at the statutory construct around these county developmental disability program areas, they're tied in state law to the mental health programs at the county level. So that link is there for us, for you, for them, and something to be aware of as you're talking about the mental health the work in the mental health community-based programs that you're doing. There's a link back to these county developmental disability programs. And I do want to just round out the spectrum of the continuum for you, because we do have, importantly, state workers that are working in the stabilization and crisis unit. So even though locally through the county developmental disability programs and the brokerages, those are not state employees, with the couple of exceptions in Umatilla, which are transitioning right now. We also have an important group of workers that work in our stabilization and crisis unit, which are group home community-based services that are, as Lilia referenced earlier, where some of our consumers who have some of the most significant challenges are served, and that's an important workforce for the totality of the system. So I just want to make sure that full breadth is in front of you.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this a group that is not currently served by the Ombudsman program, but that is a direction that they want to go for the quality assurance?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kinnegar, that is my basic understanding, but I would need to, I can go back and get additional information on that.
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kinnegar, the Ombudsman program did expand its service to include the developmental disability community, but they provide very different services than this QA program. This is a compliance-based, are we working in compliance with our federal waivers and our federal requirements in the program, which is different than a consumer response system, which is really how I think of the Ombudsman program. I just want to make sure that distinction is available.
Yeah, follow up. So is it totally separate like that? Because I do remember them talking about one of their functions is to feed back into the quality assurance, and I don't know if that was strictly consumer versus federal compliance, or if that blends it.
Maybe I can clarify this for a little bit. The ombudsman goes to foster homes, assisted living facilities, and touches these people, because some of them are in those facilities from the point of view of making sure that there's no abuse being going on and that they're being treated fairly. They don't go into these programs to see what they're getting from them, but they inspect those homes, and during that inspection they're touching the DD population, because some of the DD population is there. They don't go into private homes. That's not part of their function. And I don't believe they go into DD homes. I don't believe they go into those types of areas, but I could be wrong on that piece. And of course, they're in nursing homes also, where some of the DD elderly population is also. So they do touch them from that point of view. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Aaron, maybe you can answer this. Homes like Living Opportunities in our area, which is a DD home, I'm not sure the ombudsman goes there. I don't know for sure.
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kinnegar, I don't believe they do, but I will double check and we'll make sure the scope of both is fully accounted for when we respond. But I would like to just respond to Representative Kinnegar about the overlap. If an ombudsman in the course of their work responding to a concern by a consumer either encounters abuse and neglect, or they encounter what they consider to be a health safety regulatory issue, they make a referral back to our organization to do the follow-up. So they're not actually doing the investigation around that body of work, and they're not also accountable to the federal partnership as the accountable Medicaid entity, and in our case, we're obviously a delegate of the Oregon Health Authority as the state Medicaid agency. So there is a difference, but they often, because of their on-the-ground work responding to consumer concerns, do come across issues that then get referred back to DHS. That's why that partnership relationship between us and them is so important.
Thank you.
We also expanded family networks. These focus on peer support, and we now have 8 of these family networks located throughout the state. And you can see some of the goals of families who go through this program or who work with the family networks is they expect their children to have a paying job, they expect their child to live independently and be safe and healthy. And so these are a resource that families have and that we ultimately also use to communicate with families about our programs and what we're doing. The next slide talks about statewide transformation. Oh, that was fancy. talks about statewide transformation and the connections we have within the IDDD system to other areas of DHS. You'll be hearing a little bit later about the Employment First Initiative, and that is clearly one of our bigger initiatives in terms of transformation and working across different systems to improve the lives of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We also use the statewide abuse and reporting line for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We're working with the mental health system in a number of ways to coordinate care for individuals who are duly diagnosed and also children with mental health challenges and IDDD as well as adults. And then we're improving our partnership efforts with child welfare. We've done a lot in that area around how we provide supports to children with disabilities in the child welfare system.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Guy, would you like to join them at
yes,
the podium?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Save us a lot of time.
Hopefully this will be my last.
No,
I'm
it won't.
Curious. Yeah. You know me so well after just 3 weeks. I'm curious why you have a separate reporting line as opposed to just 211, which is so easy to remember.
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Kenny Geyer, I just want to say we did explore with 211 the option of having their number be the call point of contact as opposed to the 1-800 telephony that's listed here. It was really costly. This was a service we were self-funding internally. They were very clear with us that they needed to have new capacity and new training for their staff in order to create this particular opportunity. And I want to remind folks that this line is for all adults and kids, no matter the abuse issue statewide. And what it does is it's an electronic system. There are no people on the other end of it at the very first point of contact. And you let the number know if you're calling about an adult or a child. You let them know the community that the person that you're concerned about resides in, and then it refers you back to the appropriate place, whether that's in the adult abuse reporting system or the child abuse reporting system, or in some cases now county developmental disability systems as well. So when we stood this up, this was something the department was trying to do in response to feedback from community, from Oregonians telling us there are far too many numbers out there. We don't know which one to call, and we'd like to call one number. We did meet at length with 211 to see if that was an option, but because we hadn't sought an appropriation and because their option was much more costly, we created this. We're certainly open to doing it another way, but they do so much in terms of information and referral, and they use this line now actually to refer people to for calls about abuse, and it was just clear that that wasn't their area of expertise yet. It doesn't mean it couldn't be down the road. The governor's budget also includes dollars to make sure that 211 is statewide, and that was another issue for us, quite frankly, is we needed this option to be able to stand up immediately on a statewide basis, and they still have some capacity challenges in terms of their statewideness.
Thanks.
Representative Dr. Bates.
Aaron, just to follow up on Representative Kenny Geyer's question, how many, the classic voicemail track that you go through 2 or 3 different things, or thank you, your call's important to us, please hold for the next available, other people are ahead of you. What do they get when they call? And you said they'll be asked something like which community it's from, and then what happens? Like, take us through a call of somebody, if you just make something up, but basically what they would get, because that's concerning to me, because I'm thinking someone's calling and they're in a situation where they can't be on the phone long, but they want to tell a person what's happening. Mm-hmm. They have been told in some cases not to call 911, so that's police, fire, or medical emergency, and maybe they don't know, or maybe they're a child or something like that, but what differentiates that, and is there a point in the call where they're told to call 911?
Co-Chair Spates and Nathanson, Representative Boone, I can certainly get you a description of the tree. My understanding is there are not many steps before they talk to an actual person. They can always zero out and get right to a person if they're feeling like they're experiencing an emergency, and the person will immediately be able to help them ascertain whether they need to get to 911 or not. It's a relatively simple process in terms of adult or child, person with, you know, what community. I think there are probably no more than two or three before they end up with a live human being around the report they're trying to make. And again, they can always go to directly a person if they'd like to. We tried to make it a really simple process. I also want to just mention that for some of our mandatory reporters who are really accustomed to calling us on a particular number, those other numbers still exist, so they still could call directly to a local office or to whomever if that's something they're used to doing. This grew out of actually a legislative work group on the Elder Abuse Task Force side that made a note. We had a Clackamas County prosecutor come and gave an example of six different numbers in Clackamas County to report adult abuse that he and his office were trying to navigate to get to the right place. So what this number actually did was streamline it for him, and if it makes it faster for him and for his deputy district attorneys or people of concern in his community to get to the right place without calling the wrong number as they're trying to sort out which number to call.
And just a quick follow-up, who do they end up with when they get to that real person? Is it the first, does the phone ring and somebody says, are you going to get it? No, I'm going to get it. Or where does it get picked up?
Co-Chairs, Representative Boone, we have staff that we pay whose job it is to receive reports of abuse, and it goes to those staff.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Boone, one of the ways I check these things out, you may want to do it too, is you call the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm concerned
it's
about
it's 855-503 and it's 7233, is that correct? Mm-hmm. That SAFE stands for 7233?
Yes. It sounds close.
Yes.
I'm concerned. I don't know about you guys. I've called before where you call in and they say, you know, or to go directly to an operator, dial zero, and you dial zero because you want to talk to the real person, and then you go, thank you for calling such and such, and it starts all over again.
On our line, you've had that
experience? No. I'm just saying this happens. So I'm wondering if somebody checks it regularly to make sure that everything's flowing correctly.
Can I just comment on that one? I would say that, speaking with my physician hat on for a moment, it works fine.
Okay, good.
And I had the same concerns when this new system was implemented and we were informed about it in our practice, and I have not heard a single word from my colleagues. I have not had an opportunity to use it personally. I've called it once, as Senator Bates suggested, just to see how it works, but my colleagues seem to think it's working just fine.
Okay.
On the end of, in a group of, a large group of mandated reporters.
We might check with the ombudsman too. I expect they use this number. So, please continue.
All right, thank you.
We'll get you through this.
All right, I'll talk really fast, but very detailed. In 15-17, we faced a number of opportunities, often disguised as challenges. The first and foremost, I think you see in front of you in the numbers that we were presenting in the budget, is financial sustainability for the program. We're doing a lot of really great things. In 13-15, we got an additional $78 million match as a result of going to the CAVE plan. Now we're looking ultimately at how we sustain the program over the life of those that we're bringing into the system, but also ultimately for future Oregonians who will need to use this. So this is something that we're thinking about with our advocates and stakeholders and talking about on a regular basis. We're looking at moving to, as a result of a budget note from last session, one assessment tool for all of our different settings. We're making progress in this area. We engaged a stakeholder group. We're moving forward with the adult needs assessment and child needs assessment. We have some steps that we're implementing now where we're going to be, this is the assessment we use right now for anyone who is receiving K-Plan services in home, children and adults. We're now moving forward with using this, looking at how it works and using it with our folks who live in group homes, and then we have a plan for ultimately rolling it out. We also have an RFI out to get feedback on how we can really shore up and strengthen the assessment to make sure it works for everybody in every part of our system. We talked about this yesterday. Our new federal regulations are also presenting both challenges and opportunities. And I'm going to click real fast.
What?
Let's go back to that slide.
Would you like me to?
I think there's going to be some challenges here, and from my memory of the last two sessions, there are some challenges here. I don't know exactly where we're at now with this, and maybe we want to talk offline about it, but what's your sense of where we're going here as far as what the feds want us to do and what we're doing and how it's really affecting people in programs? I just felt there was some inappropriate expectations laid on us at one point, which actually would hurt people.
Co-Chair Bates would be happy to kind of summarize the discussion and where we're at, where I think we're at in context of these regulations. These regulations both came down from, one from Department of Labor, one from Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and ultimately with the Department of Labor regulation, we are moving forward with, we're looking to move forward with recommendations that were made by, that we discussed with the stakeholder group, and we talked about how they weren't enthusiastic endorsements, but they were recognition that we need to potentially make some policy changes given the overall fiscal impact of this particular regulation. Right now, there has been a federal court case challenging this and a ruling that kind of stays most of the regulations. The Department of Labor has requested and gotten permission to move quickly to appeal that. And so states are kind of in a we know the Department of Labor has said very clearly that even if they prevail in this case, they won't, the fact that they had this case won't change their expectation in terms of how states or their timelines for when states should implement. And so right now we're looking at how we move forward with what we need to do to implement, recognizing though that this is, there's still some uncertainty around what's happening.
Kent.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, so now you just said something there, and now you've just thrown me into the criminal justice world of things now. So there, am I hearing that right from what you just said, that they're going to ignore what the court order is?
Go ahead.
Co-chairs, Dickinson, Representative Olson.
Okay, we can all go to sleep.
Just a clarification. They're working their way through the appellate process. They firmly believe that they will prevail. And right now, there is a six-month stay of enforcement around the regulations that is set to expire right about the time they expect to finish the court process. And what they've let states know is, should they prevail, at the expiration, they expect people to have implemented the regulations or be on the course for implementing, because they don't plan on extending the timeline given the current legal uncertainty. So they've made very clear that this is a policy direction that's very important to them to pursue, and they plan on pursuing it once they complete the process. And it puts states in a dilemma because the timeline to stand up some of the complexity and the operational challenges as well as the program and policy changes are significant. I would just say, and I know the committee had a lot of discussion about this yesterday, but I just want to remind all of us that both of these regulations are not inconsistent with Oregon's overarching policy and area of emphasis around providing care to people at home and in communities in the most integrated way we possibly can. They're not without their fair share of challenges for us in our system. The good news, I think, around the home and community-based settings is that we have created a five-year plan. We have some time around the changes that need to occur to get into compliance around those new set of regulations. I think the bigger, more urgent challenge in the next biennium really is around how to address the financial implications of Department of Labor. Again, this also spills over into our conversations about employment and about the economy and about the well-being of the workforce that is serving these constituents, these consumers, because there's an inextricable relationship between the financial well-being of the provider in these instances and also then the quality of care and the well-being of the consumer. And so all of this is interrelated.
Please try to continue.
All right. I love the qualifier.
All right. The next challenge and opportunity we have is we've implemented a plan of care on our existing express billing system. This is something that increased our functionality and was done in response to CMS expectation of unbundling that day service that I talked about earlier, some requirements we have under K-Plan, and our move toward a centralized billing system for a lot of our personal support workers. We acknowledge with this that we've increased the workload for CDDPs, brokerages, and our provider community, and we are working very diligently based on their recommendation and request for added functionality. We're moving very quickly on that to try to reduce, to get that up and running so that it reduces some of the time entry that it's taking to enter in invoices and plans and different pieces into this system. So this is one of the things we're working on, and be happy to discuss this as well as, offline or even here if you'd like. Our next piece that we're going to talk about, I'll turn it over to Eric to do a budget overview.
And Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, I'll keep this quick as usual. It's the same three slides that we've gotten used to here. The IDD budget is about $2.09 billion. It is broken out into support services, which is like daily supports, personal support worker health insurance, and it includes the Department of Labor money is embedded into this part of the budget. Comprehensive services is obviously the largest slice of the pie, which is dominated by the residential facilities for adults and non-relative foster care. Design and delivery it's showing about 11% here, but you have to include the SACU as part of the program delivery. It was broken out so you could see what part of the budget the SACU budget is, and then we have employment first. On the next slide, again, 98% is in direct payments and services. Program delivery this time includes the SACU budget, the CDDPs, the brokerages, regional crisis, and local match. The SACU, CDDPs, and brokerages are about 93% of that 14%. Program design is only about 2%, and then the program is 84% of this budget.
Kutcher Bates, Representative Boone. SACU stands for the Stabilization and Crisis Unit. Those are the state-staffed group homes. And they show up in different places because they represent state employees that are doing the work as opposed to the community-based provider network that we talked about at the county or the brokerage level. So apologies for the acronyms, but we're trying to move quickly here.
No, he gets fined, so not yet. Just kidding.
On the next slide, you'll see that, again, we're dominated by federal funds. We've got about 65% of our budget is Medicaid dollars that are matched by the general fund and other fund. What I'd like to point out here is that there is no Fairview Trust money in this particular budget. So that's just a note to put out there. And then the general funds are primarily used to match Medicaid funds.
Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Bates. So I asked this question last week, and they kicked it forward and said, wait till I had you this week.
Okay.
With the K-Plan, I'm trying to figure out how we appropriately budget for the uncertainties of the K-Plan. I've read some articles that discuss the level of services that people could reach, you know, going increasing from about 20,000 a year that they were able to access to 90,000 a year to be able to access. And then at the same time, we discussed that there's a provider shortage. You know, so many more people are now able to have the ability to access services that there's a lack in the ability to meet those services. And so not everyone is using that expanded amount of access to services that the K-Plan expanded. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we actually plan for all those uncertainties if we don't know, as people figure out how to access those services. How do we plan that in our budget in a way that is any way reliable?
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Stark, it's very difficult. Part of the discussion earlier was when is this going to plateau from the in-home services, and it's really difficult to kind of look in the rearview mirror and know when it's going to plateau off. How do we budget these? We do our best to anticipate the policies that are being put in place. We try to determine where that is going to plateau off and at what point the spectrums and the level of care is going to kind of plateau off as well. So I don't have a great answer for you other than we do our best to forecast appropriately.
And follow up? Thank you, Chairman. And so am I understanding correctly on the K plan, it removed the caps so that there isn't a we budget X amount of dollars and that's all we'll spend. It's now whatever services are needed, we're going to spend that whether we budget it or not.
That's true. And as we gain more experience with the amount of money that will actually be spent, we'll have a better idea of how to budget those costs per case into the system.
Contreras Bates and Nathanson, Representative Stark, I really appreciate the question. It's been a challenge for us as well, and it's why I think you heard Lilia talk about financial sustainability as one of our challenges and focus areas as we move forward. As Eric said, the more experience we have, the better our assumptions get in terms of caseload forecasting. It's also why the department comes back every 6 months with a rebalance to this committee so that we can talk with you about where the puts of takes have been. So far this biennium, even with the K, thanks to savings in other places, we've been able to make the appropriate investments in caseload and cost per case increases in the developmental disabilities program, again, thanks to savings in other areas, so that we've not had to come and make an ask of the committee for general fund investment. And so I think we have a commitment to managing as best we can, even in the midst of the uncertainty. But it is a real challenge with a program that's going through this amount of policy change that's this significant. And remember that this particular option, the community first choice option, applies across programs, which also creates it means that if we made a change as a result of what was happening in the DD arena, that change also would apply in the aging and persons with disabilities arena as well. So adding to the complexity of challenges that the programmatic design and the way the federal government approaches this particular option has to be applicable broadly across those populations. You can't say that in this population, for instance, we want to go back to caps, but we want to not do that in other populations. That's just not an option. So it's one of those other variables across programs and why this is very new for Oregon and something we're still learning through.
Co-Chair Bates, Representative Stark, I'd just like to clarify the point that's been made. And yes, the hard caps that were in place are off. However, services are still driven or must be driven by the actual need of the individual. So I just want to make sure that we're not envisioning something happening out there that isn't. We are really looking at an assessed level of need for the individual. And we're also really talking now, we're doing a training with all of our service coordinators and personal agents about natural supports and the things that are already occurring in the person's life outside of the paid support system and how we can continue to use those to as we look at what paid supports might be available for the individual. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Sorry, I feel like we are a little bit boxed in on some of the budget issues here because we could say, you know, the co-chair's budget cut this amount and you have X amount, but with the federal guidelines and without any sort of caps, you just come back 6 months later and say, well, I'm not saying you'd do this intentionally, but you come back 6 months later and say, well, it costs more, you got to pay more, regardless of what we set the budget at.
Senator Bates, Representative Stark, I would say that that's it is our goal, and we need to look at our cost curve and where our cost curve is headed, just because as part of this program, we know that it won't work. It's not going to be sustainable over the long term mm-hmm. if we aren't doing things within the program itself to kind of drive, bend the cost curve and get it where we need it to go in the context of Medicaid. And I would, you know, there are other Medicaid programs that are also entitlements, and they do this in a way, and now it's just using a system. Really, this is part of the fundamental change in the IDDD service system, is really looking at how we do these services as an entitlement, but do it in such a way that it's cost effective over the long term.
And I do want to say I appreciate your guys' work. My frustration is with the federal mandates of you're going to have to pay this, and you don't really have a lot to say about it. So my frustration is not with you guys. I clarify that.
And if to make you feel any better, we do look at these, at the caseloads, the cost per caseload very carefully. We've managed to balance and rebalance that through the process so far. I think we'll continue to do so. Long term, there's probably some significant savings. This is really a program that's set up to prevent people moving into more expensive and more restrictive environments, and giving them the best quality of life we possibly can. Long term, this should be a very beneficial program, as the CCOs are, and on the medical side, saving substantial amounts of money. I think we'll be ending up the same place. The conversion from one to the other is the real challenge. Learning how to control those costs, get appropriate care to these people, appropriate supports is more difficult, but I think you guys will get there. We've luckily done some other things, differential response, some other issues that we've dealt with that have become more efficient, and be able to move money from one side to the other, which is appropriate. So I have a lot of confidence in people to do it, but there are risks. Anytime we make a change, there's a risk that we're moving in the right direction. And the discussion you generate here was actually a big discussion last session when we decided whether or not to go with the K waiver. We were halfway through session before that decision was finally made over the very issues you brought up. So I appreciate your questions and the discussion. Thank you. We're going to cut you off here in 5 minutes.
All right. Real quick, our future investments or what we're looking at for 15-17, what's in our plan budget? The first is grants to build capacity for IDD clients with significant long-term needs. This really is about, in a lot of ways, the population we've talked about, our stabilization and crisis units. We have individuals there that could transition to community-based providers, and this is part of our initiative to transition and do that so that we can focus that workforce and really do the job we need to do with those high level of need people that we have coming into the system on a regular basis. We also have in the proposed budget a 4% provider rate increase for non-bargain rates that starts January 1st, 2016. This is an effort to help with the areas of capacity and helping our provider community as they move forward in serving the increased number of people that we have coming into our system and the supports that we have happening now. We're also looking at funding our community developmental disability programs and brokerages at 95% equity. This is the first year this is the first budget process that we move from a caseload model for these brokerages and CDPs to a workload model, and we're proposing funding them at 95% equity, recognizing the significant work and efforts that they've engaged in over the past couple of years, and with movement to the K and all of the things that they're addressing. Within the DD budget, we have the $35 million that's been identified for the Department of Labor investment. I want to clarify with that's the $35 million total is in the DD budget, but only a portion of that would go to fund this liability for DD. The rest would also cover what's happening with APD. So we talked about it yesterday, but I wanted to clarify that in the context of the IDDD budget. We also have a policy option package to continue our efforts around employment first and helping people with intellectual and developmental disabilities attain and maintain integrated employment.
And thank you.
That wraps it up for IDD.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't studied the policy option package yet in detail. But I wanted to return to slide 22 for a moment, mostly because I'd like to get it on the record in this meeting today. I've received several communications about this. It's a big issue. We have a budget situation that we may have to face. People are asking for help in dealing with the problems that they feel have been imposed on them by using a different system. So there are budget implications, there are program implications because it's a system that's very burdensome, they're having difficulty using it. It's also an IT issue, so I'm starting to think about how it relates to our new IT subcommittee of Joint Ways and Means. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm concerned about this because we're getting communications about it from the people who are trying to work with the system in the field in our districts. I didn't want today to go by without you knowing that We are paying attention, and we do need to discuss it some more.
Coach Bates, Coach Nathanson, thank you. We are, I think as Lilia said, we're actively working on a solution that was requested by the providers that should streamline things. We know we've mentioned already the workload that this has created, and really the drivers that you see here in terms of the unbundling. I guess I do want to comment on the issue around the IT project issue. This was an existing system that has been enhanced to do this work and is working. It's paid hundreds of thousands of claims, and it, you know, we had a public hearing on this on the 10th of February, I believe, in the Senate committee, and there was a full vetting by many voices that had a chance to have an oversight hearing and really hear about what the department's work is to both address the concerns and also the things that have been done to date about how the system's functioning. We'd be happy to provide you with that information. We do know that the provider community is asking for some financial remediation around the increased administrative responsibility that now is associated with this. And we appreciate that that's something we want to be able to talk about with you on the go forward. I guess the other point I would make is that in the future investments, there are really some investments in infrastructure that I think they would say probably are not sufficient. And so I guess I would just point to that too, that the workload model investments for CGDPs and brokerages will move forward. Some increases for them, as will the provider rate increases, which is a little bit different issue. But all of this is interconnected with the system and the requirements that we're really in the process of implementing, many of which, as Representative Stark said, are associated with federal reviews, federal program changes, and also, at the end of the day, really about allowing us to be able to have a system that is accountable to you all, that focuses on some of the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. So all of that's together, but the process of getting there has been definitely a challenge for everybody.
Thank you.
Brief follow-up.
Okay. We're a little follow-up.
It's very
quick.
I understand that the system is working, but I guess my point is, at what cost? I know how to use a typewriter. I used to use a typewriter. I don't choose to go back and use a typewriter. There are other things I can use now. I am concerned about not having thought through the cost to everybody, the providers as well as the state, for a solution we put in place. It reminds me of other discussions we're having in general government subcommittee and an IT subcommittee, which is, what does the business need? Don't let a quick IT solution take the place of really fully understanding what needs to be done, because I'm concerned that something was created without fully understanding the cost. Thank you.
Thank you. I think the prerogative of the chair here not allow any more questions. We want to get a grant taken care of. We have not finished this presentation about employment first. We want to try to run that real quick. You want to bring in the grant? We're running short here.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, we need to do the grant today because it has been scheduled and posted for a work session. As far as employment first, if they can cover it in a couple minutes, we could do it today, or we could talk about it tomorrow. It does segue into the vocational rehabilitation discussion, so if they can do it fast.
Aaron, what's your pleasure?
Co-Chairs Bates and Nathanson, why don't we plan on doing it tomorrow? It'll give us a little more time to shorten up both presentations to fit within the window that we have.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're going to move from a public hearing on DD to a work session. I'm going to open a work session on request to apply for federal grant for perinatal and infant oral health grant. Linda, you want to lead us through this real quick? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people in their care don't
ungrip their hands.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Kate Wilcox is here today from Public Health to request permission to apply for a federal grant. Both the agency letter and an LFO and summary analysis are on OLIS if you want to look at those. But Kate was aware that she wouldn't be talking too long this morning.
You have till 10 o'clock, and then you lose your quorum and you lose your grant. So let's go ahead and make your decision.
I understand. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Kate Wilcox. I'm the Maternal and Child Health Manager in the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. In that section, the oral health program for the division sits. To my right is Shaney Mason, who is our oral health program manager. I'm here to request approval to apply for this Federal Health Services and Resources Administration grant. It's called the Perinatal and Infant Oral Health Quality Improvement Expansion Program Grant. It's quite a name. The expansion part may be a little bit of a misnomer or misunderstanding. HRSA had a prior phase, a pilot phase, that was tested in 3 states. And so this expansion is opening up this opportunity to all states, of which we would then be eligible. Our grant application will focus on 3 key areas for the infant and pregnant women populations. First, it will include collaboration with CCOs to establish organizational policies that promote and support provision of dental services to infants during well-child visits and risk assessments and oral health information to pregnant women during the prenatal visits. Secondly, it includes training of medical providers to increase understanding and skilled use of evidence-based oral health practices for infants and pregnant women during well-child and prenatal visits. And lastly, it includes a collaboration with programs at the community level, such as WIC and home visiting, to increase coordination and referrals of these services. The grant is a 4-year grant, providing up to $250,000 per year. They say up to because sometimes we're not sure what the federal budget will allow, for a total of up to $1 million for the course of this grant. The grant period is August 2015 through July 2019 and requires no state matching funds or maintenance of effort. This grant will require no new positions. Rather, we're going to repurpose 2 existing positions that have grants that are ending or are on other grants, and we can repurpose them. With that, I will open it up to questions if you have any.
Questions.
Actually, if I may, Mr. Chair, a couple of comments. First of all, thank you for doing this. Second of all, for my colleagues who aren't clear why this is important, if anybody isn't, let me just say that we know that oral health is an indicator for risk for preterm birth, and preterm birth is an indicator for lifelong learning disabilities and certainly is expensive, although that shouldn't be our biggest reason to avoid it. It's also clear that long-term oral health begins for babies while they're in utero, and certainly in that first year, a mother's oral health determines to a large extent her child's oral health. We have long held that people don't need to go to the dentist for a while. Now we have the first tooth prospect, and many children are getting their first teeth before 6 months of age. So these kinds of programs to educate both families and providers for these families are critically important, and I really want to commend you all for pursuing this, and I look forward to being helpful and if I can be. So thank you very much. I didn't mean to steal your thunder, but I wanted to make it clear for the record why these programs are so important and why I'm so excited about this grant.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, which agency is granting a no-match grant?
Senator Bates, Senator Nathanson, Representative Boone. A lot of our grants that we get do not require a match. Some do and some don't, but for purposes for this one, they are not. And
which how
this is HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration within DHHS. So it's sort of by, I don't know how they determine that at the federal level, but lucky us. Huh?
Lucky. Thank you.
Hello, Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to echo what Senator Steiner Hayward said. This is a really needed area, and I have several prenatal and childhood preventative health bills that the Health Committee will see that maybe this committee will eventually see. So a very important area. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nathan.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion?
God, yes.
I move that the Joint Committee on Ways and Means approve the Oregon Health Authority's submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to improve oral health.
Thank you. We have a motion for the grant. Is anyone here opposed to this motion? Seeing none, so moved. You got your grant. Go get the money, okay?
Thank you
Good
very
luck.
Much.
All right. And we need a carrier for full. So,
No,
I will probably be here. So
I'll take it then. Thank you, quite happily.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are adjourned. Thank you very much for everyone coming today. Good.